Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick. With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yep, absolutely. Yep, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep me down, love.
Hi, gang, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
If you need the lav, go now. There's a bucket in the corner.
Nick Alder.
I've been sick, and I want chicken.
And Tom Stab.
Big fresh gobs.
So welcome to the latest episode of Monkey Tennis, where we'll be cracking open Alan's time capsule. We're looking this week at episodes 10 and 11 of Alan's own Audible podcast, From the Oast House. Before we get cracking, if you're enjoying what you've heard from us over the last 100 plus episodes, then please do consider dropping us the price of a coffee at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. You can donate £3 or 15 if you're feeling very generous and you want all of us and producer Jed to have a coffee each. The money goes towards making future episodes of Monkey Tennis and keeping this show on the road. Equally, if you've got any thoughts, comments or suggestions about our podcast or Alan's, get in touch on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, facebook.com/The Partridge Pod, or you can email thepartridgepod@gmail.com. We also have a hotline where you can leave voice notes for a future episode, 07923 600 017. But tits to all that, I'm sure we can work something out. It's time to open Alan's time capsule. This is, I hope no one will disagree with me here, probably one of the most enjoyable episodes of the series, because it's packed with throwbacks to previous Partridge.
And also quite a lot of revelations about, the Partridge family that we've kind of been speculating about for a long time. I think you find out quite a lot about what's been going on in the family history, more so than you've done with any of the other kind of Partridge outputs.
Absolutely. And backstory is what I want from my Partridge content.
Well, you are in luck, Adam, because we're about to talk for an hour about that backstory.
Great.
That is the great thing, though, isn't it? Like, the more Partridge content you get, the more fun you can have delving into the backstory. It just becomes richer and richer every time there's something new.
So we open in Audible, right?
Yes, with someone crying at podcasts.
So, yeah, Alan is in Audible. He's in the toilets and he hears two men in the bathroom. And he hears that One of them has cried at a podcast, which, because the podcast was on dads and he's obviously a father, so it stands to reason that could be an emotional kind of touching subject. Alan can't believe this and so kind of bursts out and quizzes them on it, and four subsequent visitors to the toilet yep. to see if they've also cried, which it turns out everyone's been crying at podcasts.
I've just thought that reminds me a bit of when he's canvassing people about hand washing coming in and out of the toilets on this yep. time.
It's not even the first time he's conducted a survey yes. at the toilet. Yeah. So quick question to the group. Have you ever cried at a podcast? I think I might have shed a tear at something particularly Ooh. Emotional. I can't think what,
I seem to remember crying listening to one of the This American Life podcasts quite early on. But I can't remember specifically what it was about. I think that's the only one.
I think for me, it was listening to the first Adam Buxton episode where he talked about his dad's death.
Because he was so emotional
talking about it.
Yeah, and on a similar note, a question to the audience. Has an episode of Monkey Tennis ever made you cry? For good or bad reasons, please do get in touch through the usual channels. Alan is compiling a time capsule of himself. That's right, isn't it?
We'll kind of get into this, or maybe it's even worth a bit of a wrap-up at the end, but I did think all of this episode was kind of tinged with quite a lot of sadness, because for all of Alan's failings, you know, the reason as to why he's having to pull together this time capsule is actually quite tragic, to be fair to him. So I thought the whole episode had a kind of a slightly demure quality.
Do you think the thrust of this episode then is that the audible meeting about people crying at podcasts has set Alan on a journey to try and make a podcast that will make people cry, but then what's happened is he's actually almost tricked himself into making an episode that is genuinely quite moving?
Yeah, I think that's quite a good summarisation, and I think the emotive heft of it almost materialises by accident. But yeah, I think the setup for this episode is brilliant, because essentially, Alan thinks it's hilarious that people cry at podcasts. And there's a very key line at the top of this episode. He says, if people want to make podcasts designed to elicit tears, that's their lookout. It feels a bit cynical to me, a bit manipulative, not really my kind of thing. My podcast is just me doing things I'd be getting up to anyway. And then a couple of seconds later, anyway, today you join me in my loft as I attempt to compile a simple time capsule of memories and snapshots of my life for my grandchildren, who I have never met.
And then the backing music comes in.
Yes, exactly that. So he's pulling on the emotive heartstrings anyway. But what I really love about that, like the way he lays out the reasoning for doing Nomad, it's like finding that excuse to go in the loft to find a box of his father's artifacts and his excuse to do that walk. So in Nomad, there's a bit when he writes, there will be those that doubt that I'd stretch my lips in the first place, or don't believe a cut-out handle looks anything like a mouth. Those who think this all feels conveniently neat, or a confused mess, or a blatant attempt to drum up poignancy. To those people, I say, oh, are you calling me a liar? So it's exactly the same thing. It's just he's basically thought of a way, how can I drum up some emotive poignancy by doing this?
And it even starts in the loft again. That's where he gets his cheek pathos from.
Yes.
So we learned that Alan has two grandchildren, both Fernando's children, Jack 4 and Ruby 3. Of course, Nanny Carol has met them. We know this from Nomad, where we get the revelation that Alan is a granddad. And like Nick said at the beginning, yeah, actually very, very sad, the fact that Alan only really sees them over Instagram from a family friend. Mm. It's a 20-minute birthday video, isn't it? And Alan puts on his own party hat and pretends to be a clown, like that they're laughing at him. It's quite sad.
That's deeply tragic, that bit as well, where he's having to pretend that he's in the video as a clown. I mean, being a clown anyway is a little bit odd, but the idea that you'd watch a 20-minute video of your grandchildren's party that you're not invited to, and then you project yourself into the video and dress yourself up as that clown, was both tragic and slightly scary.
And also a nice nod to previous Partridge. He says that the nose he uses to dress as a clown is the one that he wore for Comic Relief in 99, which I believe is one of the years when he did some work for Comic Relief. A couple of other little revelations. One is that he says Denise is never going to produce children because it's just a lifestyle thing. And also we learn, I believe, that Alan has a therapist, but Freck chooses to frame it instead as a man I pay to chat to.
I would say we've jumped ahead a little bit, because there are a few other details that come at slightly before him viewing the children's party from the perspective of a clown. The fact that he says, when he's talking about the grandkids, he says, one's a lovely little fella, the other's a girl. I thought that's a great mirror to exactly how he talks about Fernando and Denise. Denise is always the afterthought. So the thing about Denise with it being a lifestyle, he says she lives in Hebden Bridge, Now, I don't know if you guys were aware of this. I wasn't aware of this until I did a bit of Googling. But basically, Hebden Bridge is known as the UK's lesbian capital. So, because I was a bit like, oh, lifestyle thing, is that a veiled hint about her being a lesbian, perhaps? And with the Hebden Bridge edition, it very much definitely is.
Where's that then? Is that Manchester somewhere?
It is in
West Yorkshire.
And of course, further evidence of Alan's prejudice, the idea that firstly calling the fact that she's gay a lifestyle thing is offensive in and of itself. But also the assumption in 2020 that a gay woman couldn't have children is further evidence that Alan is kind of unintentionally behind the times.
When I was saying about the inventing the kind of premise to create the podcast for Poignancy, I mean, he does actually address that head on exactly like he does in Nomad, literally the line. If that sounds suspicious, like the type of podcast you said you don't do, I say again, I was going to be doing this anyway, and I just so happened to be recording it. That's very key.
There's a nice joke within a joke here. I guess it's the point I made earlier, but Alan's obviously pretending not to make a podcast that will make us cry, but the details he keeps getting distracted by are the things that actually could. They could make, you know, they're the elements that do or could make you cry.
I enjoyed the kind of build as the final roll of the dice where he's asked to meet Fernando on Father's Day. Also, because it coincides with the anniversary that he first met Carol, which I think is new Carol detail. I don't think that we knew that was kind of on Father's Day. And then there's a nice little bit of bonus info where he includes a pack of sunflower seeds, which, again, you know, it's quite a tragic plea from a father to a son. So I guess it's, you know, it's as we've discussed, it's his attempt to maybe literally and figuratively sow the seeds of emotion via sunflower seeds.
and I think you're right. You definitely do start feeling quite sorry for the character when you add together all these things about learning about he's only up to date with what the family do via an Instagram feed, the fact that it's on Father's Day and the anniversary of him meeting Carol. You have all these things layered on top of each other to definitely build that emotive impact.
I'm also concerned about the qualifications that Alan's therapist has, because firstly, Alan's aversion to things like therapy and the fact he has to reframe it as a man I pay to chat to also leads me to believe that he wouldn't have hired a therapist that was good because he wouldn't want to have gone in for the kind of the phrasing that therapists use to describe themselves. So I think he maybe has just gone to someone who's not very qualified, because the idea of this time capsule has come from his therapist, and a therapist has recommended this as a way to close the door on the issue of his grandchildren. So it's almost like, I can't imagine a therapist recommending that you just give up on ever seeing your grandkids again, and that the answer is just to do a time capsule and bury it. That's the opposite of what a therapist would do.
But then they did also advise that him watching 20-minute videos wasn't hugely healthy. So at least that's a better bit of advice to stop doing that.
I feel like anyone picked off the street could tell you that, though. True. I don't think you need to be a qualified therapist.
No, I guess this is the first time that there's been any admission of Alan seeing a therapist, right? Has that been layered in anywhere before? I don't think
I've got a feeling it has. Maybe in Nomad as a little throwaway line. I'm sure someone will correct us. They always do.
In reference to your point, Adam, about therapists, it made me think of the approach that he takes with chiropodists in Nomad, which is to play them off against each other to essentially drive down the price. And his barometer of quality is value. So I also reckon that is probably what he's looking for in a counsellor. It's not credentials, it's value.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And it ties in nicely that, you know, a therapist to him is a man I pay to chat to, in a similar way that, you know, probably quite serious depression was him being clinically fed up.
There's a bit of an update about the promise of the Oast House becoming a true crime series. Mm-hmm. I think this is classic Alan, when we've been here before, where he justifies the kind of the promise of it being a true crime series and goes at length to give you the detail that would suggest that it definitely could have been a true crime podcast. However, he played it to a trusted friend who says that it didn't work on any level, and so it's been kind of essentially buried, although crucially not deleted. I wondered, who do we think the friend might be that he played it to, or is that friend fictitious, and either he never did any of this, or he's just thought to himself, this is rubbish, I need to get rid of it.
Surely it's Daryl Flench.
And his friend.
Flenchy.
There's more justification from Alan that comes up next as well. He says, it's not about me telling them I'm a broadcaster. It's me telling them I'm a grandfather, father, husband, estranged husband, writer, thinker, rambler, dancer, joker, not a midnight toker. And did you guys spot that he, of course, says more mangled lexicon here. He says, sorry, getting confused with the David Miller Band. Of course, he means the Steve Miller Band. But brilliant. That's something I definitely didn't spot on the first listen, but I did on the subsequent.
Oh, I didn't notice that either. That's great.
Yeah, there are so many good jokes like that. But I think it's definitely, there's definitely a lot of re-listen value to this series for those sort of details.
So Alan's advice is dump the doobie, bin the bifter, pick up an anorak and take in Constable's landscape. So basically get out and about in nature. Did enjoy that there was also a kind of another dig at affordable housing in the Greenbelt, something that Alan is, you know, vehemently kind of opposed. Instead, he just says, well, why not just make buildings in the inner city taller? And at that point, they'll be able to see the countryside from the considerable views that they'll have.
Stay in the city and go higher.
Yeah. So at this point, Alan is convinced that one day, obviously, the family are going to have to come to the house because Alan will have died. And so that they're going to be keen to kind of sell what's of value and dump all the cheap pine, effectively. One thing Fernando and Denise might not have considered is that when they go into the house, Seldom will be in mourning at this point, which I also enjoy because the idea that the dog is just left in the house to mourn Alan and also that... How soon is Alan expecting to die and how old is Seldom? Obviously, things that we're not entirely clear on, but the timeline I found interesting.
I also think that the chances of Seldom mourning Alan are probably significantly lower than the chance of Seldom eating Alan, given enough time.
Once kind of they open the front door of the house to go in and see what possessions he has, Alan says that Seldom is basically going to just run into the woods where he'll find an oak tree where Alan once climbed as a child, and there Seldom will rest with his master.
And that's the oak tree that he climbed in iPartridge, I believe. So that's probably another reference back to the APU.
I assume so.
Yeah, absolutely. We also kind of get additional detail about how whilst Fernando and his wife are kind of rummaging around Alan's personal possessions, the grandchildren will be intrigued by the attic hatch. I'm not entirely sure how intrigued children actually will be with an attic hatch, especially if they're like basically toddlers. But who knows? So Alan's obviously set up, what would you describe it as?
Like a treasure hunt, I suppose?
Yeah, I guess. Like some kind of treasure hunt that ultimately ends with some kind of video message from him on a 60-inch Bravia TV where they'll open the hatch, they'll go up, Alan's face will come on, and I've got the message that Alan will play to them, but I don't know if anyone either wanted to draw out key highlights or if there's anything particularly that you enjoy from it.
I quite like the line, I will always watch over you if it's practical.
I like the bit where he cuts it while he's sort of reading or saying what he will say on the TV. He says, oh, if you're the estate agent, if you see my son, no mention of reconciling with Denise, no mention of Denise whatsoever. It's just, if you see my son.
Yeah, Denise is always the afterthought whenever he talks about
that. Well, in this case, she's not even a thought.
Yeah. I also noted down... he apologises for being a pretty crummy dad. I think that the use of that phrase, pretty crummy, that seems to appear quite a lot in this Gibbons era of Alan. It's quite a familiar part of his lexicon at this point.
So essentially this message, it's quite long, but the vast majority of it is caveats or explanations or notes to the estate agent. There's almost very little detail for the actual kind of grandkids. What you do get right at the very end of the message is, right, that's the admin over. Let me tell you about my favourite meal, eggs. I did not expect Alan's favourite meal to be eggs. Although he does kind of go and say eggs on, but at that point the message is cut off. It just cuts out. So I assume it's eggs on toast or something similar. But yeah, Alan's favourite meal is eggs.
I'm not surprised by that because he's talked about having an egg medley in the past.
Well, yeah, I'm certainly not suggesting that he doesn't enjoy an egg. I'm just saying that as a rug pull of Alan's favourite meal is eggs, that just seems like an interesting choice as your favourite meal.
I did wonder as well, does Seldom really love eggs or has Seldom not had much choice in that matter?
I think that's entirely true, but I also think that perhaps that's come back to bite Alan on the arse, because now Alan doesn't get a look in as far as eggs are concerned, because they're all required for the absolutely massive amounts that Seldom eats, as we'll find out in a later episode.
I had two quick bits before we move on to the time capsule itself. I don't know if anybody kind of had any thoughts on the bit when Alan's talking about the imagined house clearing and talking about his own drawings and picture frames. I thought it was quite an interesting returning trope of his imagination always kind of lets him down and goes to the bleakest available option. So he visualises Fernando and his wife binning Alan's own drawings, but just keeping the picture frames. So even in his imagination, he can't allow himself to imagine that his artwork would hold any sentimental value to his family, which I thought was quite consistent with what we know about Alan's imagination. And just another quick point on his age. So he's hoping that he's got longer than 2020 to live. So arguably, he is aged 65 in 2020. I think we've fact-checked this across various APU sources. His birthday should be the 2nd of April 1955. So you'd like to think that he's got a few years on him yet, but there is a weird age dispute, which I think comes up later in this episode, possibly.
Should we get into the items that are contained within the time capsule?
Let's do it.
So it's basically a mix of items that are kind of personal to him or that just paint a picture of life in 2020. He also feels the need to include some protein balls that, by his own admission, he doesn't like. So inexplicably, they've been included. He also includes a copy of The Telegraph, The Express, The Mail and The Mail on Sunday. So a genuinely balanced perspective on British journalism in 2020.
All sides.
Sides. And he also finds some bank statements. He just rummages through those and decides to put those in. And a shower head as well. I do kind of like that, again, sort of like the way he delivers it, where he's kind of like, I'll put it in.
It's prefaced. The bank statement thing is like, it gives a real sense of what life was like. So the bank statement was that he withdrew £40 from a cash machine. Real deep insight into what Pops must have been like.
I don't know about anybody else, but conversations around time capsules, for me, it just makes me think of Blue Peter. Anybody else with me on this? Because Blue Peter used to quite regularly do time capsules.
I think Blue Peter and primary schools are responsible for maybe 95% of all time capsules.
Yeah, I mean, as a concept, they're kind of the ones keeping it alive. And I think they did... So they did one... I think the one that I vaguely remember, I did have to do a bit of Wikipedia searching on this, but they buried one in 1998 under the O2, or the Millennium Dome, as it was then, and it was accidentally dug up in 2017. So it wasn't supposed to be unearthed until 2050, and they accidentally dug it up doing some building work 33 Brilliant. Years early. So apparently in that time capsule, I think they got viewers to suggest what should go in it. So that time capsule included rollerblade wheels, an asthma inhaler, Teletubby dolls, a France 98 World Cup football, a picture of a dove to symbolise peace in Northern Ireland, and a book by Roald Dahl.
Fascinating.
I mean, is that better or worse than Alan's time capsule?
That tells you nothing about like 1998 or 1999 or whatever. That's
genuinely
just
a mixed bag, I would say. During the rummage for things to go in this time capsule, he finds some CNA pants, which I thought was a nice throwback because he starts talking about vulcanized linings that don't perish. Almost one of the most blatant fan service bits of this episode, I guess, in terms of vulcanized rubber linings and Iron Man and Partridge.
Have we jumped ahead of the neighbour story, which was...
I'm jumping around all over the place here, yeah. Okay. I mean, also, before the neighbour story, we discovered that Rosa is hired from Total Cleaning Solutions. I don't know if anyone else looked this up, but I did. It really exists, and it is in Norfolk, but there are no reviews online, and the website is currently for sale from ray@dragonukgroup.com. So if anybody wants to pick that up, you could technically become Rosa's employer.
I'm a big fan of the neighbour story because of obviously Alan's sort of leanings or suggestions that this podcast could become a true crime podcast. I thought maybe is this another sort of string to that bow where eventually it is going to maybe further down the line turn into a bit of a true crime thing. Alan spots his neighbour next door looking around, looking a bit shifty. He's got bing bags. He's looking pale. He's got a big wheelie bin. He borrowed some trimmers from Alan, I think.
Borrowed Alan's hedge trimmer, yeah.
Yeah, and he's sort of like carrying around six or seven bags and looking a bit suspicious. Now, at this point, did anyone think that this might actually turn into a narrative strand, or did you think it was just queuing up for a gag, which it turns out, spoiler alert, it is?
Well, I quite enjoyed the way it does lead you that way because he keeps on adding these things. I can't believe he's doing this, he's doing that. I've seen this weird behaviour. I haven't seen his wife, and
that's a big wheelie bin.
I thought it was a lot of fun.
The punchline is that he says, "Oh, I haven't seen the wife in a while." Oh, there she is.
Yeah,
so good.
I had one more thing I think before we go back to what else is going into the time capsule that he he talks about playing with an Airfix model of a Lancaster bomber in the summer of 65. And obviously we know that Alan has form with Airfix models. So both in Nomad and I Partridge, we have the exact same sentence about setting fire to an Airfix Messerschmitt and putting it behind his bedroom door. So, well, putting it behind his father's bedroom door so he'd be intoxicated by the burning plastic. But it's at this point when he's... It's just after that, I think, doesn't he say about being... Yeah, later in this episode, he talks about being nearly 60. But obviously, it just doesn't tally because he's talking there about making an Airfix model in the summer of 65, which ties in with him being 10 doing that. When he later in the episode talks about being 60, which would mean he was 4 or 5.
What you're saying is we should fact check all of the Gibbons writing before it's published.
I mean, that's what we're doing episode by episode anyway.
Is it time to move on to an apology to Ross Kemp?
Yes, but just before that, I'd like to say also going in the time capsule, I believe, is a trophy made for him by Corsaville Mouthwash back when he used to use the catchphrase for them, Big Fresh Gobs. Which I enjoyed.
And you also have a maroon shirt from 1973 going in
and
as well.
And a shower head. So, again, things that really do give an insight into Alan's life for Jack and Ruby. So we do get a kind of lackluster apology at this point for Ross Kemp for suggesting he was overly muscled. And they've made a pleased, actually, to make a donation to the Lance Armstrong Foundation. is that a gag because Lance Armstrong is a, what, disgraced figure of sport? Or
absolutely.
Is that yes. a joke?
Yes, and I think this whole disclaimer read through gritted teeth is great because not only does it imply that Ross Kemp is litigious as all hell, but I think possibly for Steve Coogan it also scratches a Rebecca Wade phone hacking itch of his because Ross Kemp used to be married to Rebecca Wade, who was editor of of the newspaper in question.
Excellent. I hadn't thought of that, to be honest.
And the kind of gritted teeth thing is very much like when he has to read the credits at the end of Nomad, isn't it?
Yes, there's another example of that, and I'm trying to think what it is, actually. But he's definitely done that kind of, you know, it's the Noel Edmonds thing, actually. It's Noel Edmonds on Mid-Morning Matters. Do you remember? He has to kind of read a kind of, like, glowing endorsement of all of all of his kind of, you know, achievements. He has got form here.
Well, he sounds annoyed and bored in equal measure.
Yeah, but crucially, he has to read it. it's time to go back to Twitter, and Alan is asking what you would put in a time capsule. So Carl has tweeted and he needs assurances that this will be airtight, but he's going to put Kirsty Allsop in a time capsule because she's quite frankly unbearable. Is this a veiled message from Coogan, do we think?
I wouldn't be surprised, and I can't disagree.
I'll be honest, I don't really have any opinion on her, but Carl obviously, and Alan obviously do. Alan drops his phone down the hatch and at this point realises he's trapped because basically Rosa is no longer about. That's kind of what his go-to in terms of shouting out for Rosa to help him. But no, she's not there. So Alan at this point is basically trapped in the attic and starts panicking. He starts kind of weighing up his options. And considers maybe doing a parachute roll out of the hatch, although he's clear on the theory, but thinks in practice he's probably not going to be able to do that.
He describes himself as just a granddad in the autumn of his years, trapped both mentally and physically. And yeah, as I say, he's planning to jump, but he says he's nearly 60. We know that age doesn't quite check out. But he did recently do the star jump to illustrate the programme World in Action to somebody.
I love the bit when he suggests that his knee would turn to dust like when you prod an old grey wasp's nest with a broom handle. There are quite a few times when he gives a really specific example, which definitely means it's something that he's done recently. That's not like a universal phrase, is it?
Yeah.
So he starts contemplating potential sleeping options within the loft. And it's at this point that we get a returning mention of the word Dracula, which I'm sure most of us were happy to hear. So that's not just a one-off. That's kind of confirmation that Alan just pronounces it Dracula for whatever reason.
We had a tweet on this a couple of days ago from, I think it's pronounced Raging1982. So they wrote, "Hi, guys. I've just had an idea. Does Alan think Dracula is the American pronunciation of Dracula, as in nuclear? I'm struggling to get the pronunciations right, but because she writes, because we know about his dislike of American things. I mean, I think my response to that would be, it could be that, or it could be by this point the Gibbons are putting it in the scripts now just so they know that we'll have to spend time assessing something that probably has no actual significant meaning.
It's just busy work for us, isn't it, really? Yeah.
So a car is pulling up, and Alan shouts hello. Some kids are getting out. I must admit, I didn't kind of see this coming, but it's Jack and it's Ruby. Although crucially not with Fernando, apparently with a nanny, which seems a bit odd, possibly a chink into Fernando's financial situation if he's just got a nanny out and about with him. But yeah, Alan kind of yells out, it's Alan Partridge. You say it's Alan Partridge colon granddad?
Yes.
Yes.
And
I did enjoy that one of the kids shouts out, aha!
Yeah, I love that.
Oh, I completely missed that.
Oh, yeah. Go back and listen to that. It's really good.
I saw someone mention on Twitter saying that there's one of the best aha uses in the Alan Partridge history. And after listening to it all the way through, I couldn't remember a single aha from it.
It's
so I completely missed that.
Yeah.
Definitely
so
get that.
Good. I
really
love
good.
As well, like, I think normally if he's being greeted with an aha, he'd hate it. But because it's the grandkids, he's excited and he loves it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to go back and listen to that.
He's paranoid about people knowing where his spare key is, so that's been muted out, which, to be fair, if you know or you can work out from the instructions that you were talking about earlier, Adam, I can see where they might want to kind of mute that out. Essentially, the kids come to his rescue, so he's been saved by his own grandchildren, and they're off to climb a tree. And I think that pretty much wraps us up.
I like that he's been so poignant about not meeting his own grandchildren, and then when they finally arrive, he's immediately irritated by them not listening to him properly. That was good fun.
Yeah, and especially when you remind yourselves that they're three and four at this point, and he's going, listen to me, because they're not listening to his instructions about pulling up the ladder.
And so, yes, we're on to episode 11, Corporate Work. Alan says, thank you for listening, and please carry on listening. I love how excited he is about corporate work, especially as it's traditionally the work that no one enjoys, you know, and certainly in the world of comedy, you hear nothing but complaints about people having to do corporate gigs and, you know, in terms of like creative arts and like
having
film production. Yeah, I don't know. It's no one's favourite work, is it? But it's Alan's favourite work.
Yeah, exactly. It's a necessary evil for, I imagine, any kind of creative type because it is so lucratively paid. So it's the project that helps you to buy that house or whatever it might do. Or helps you to fund you kind of doing a more kind of creative endeavour. But you're quite right. Alan's kind of flipped the narrative where for him, that's the work that he enjoys, not any of his kind of creative outlets. So, yeah, I enjoyed that as well.
Just an extension of what you just said, Nick, I always enjoy the story or anecdote that Danny Baker refers to where he lives in Blackheath as the house that Daz built.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Not to jump ahead too much, maybe, but I think this is, for me, comfortably the weakest episode of the series so far. I haven't got a huge amount on this. It wasn't one that I got a lot of enjoyment from, a lot of laughs from. I don't know if anyone kind of agrees.
I think I'd agree. I mean, it's a fun listen, and I think Alan, immersed in the corporate world, is very much what you'd expect from the character. So, it's an enjoyable enough episode. But I think when it comes to something to kind of analyse and dig into, I don't think there's really much to it. It's all quite surface level.
So thank you very much. We'll be back
cheers.
Next week.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Alan is confused as to why you can get dressed up for Gay Pride but not Remembrance Sunday, and we find out that Alan went to a Remembrance Sunday event, or to the Cenotaph, dressed as a giant poppy.
He thought the event could use some more levity, and he's since stopped doing charity work.
At this point, doesn't he say he feels fizzy as well about more corporate work, which is another kind of key word in the Partridge lexicon in the Gibbons age, Alan being fizzy and fizzing with ideas.
Again, yes. Alan is very excited and enthusiastic about his corporate work, but is there an argument to say that the only reason that is the case is because it's the only work that he can regularly get? So therefore, if he's excited about it, then it kind of paints him in a, like, I'm successful because I'm doing what I love, as opposed to what we actually secretly know is that he just wants to be on the telly.
I think that's partially true, but also, as he's talking about the work he does for a new social media channel for a well-known Korean car brand, he says that he genuinely likes the people, and unlike his TV and charitable work, he knows he's making a difference.
Yeah. I also enjoyed that he kind of says that it feels like you're part of a family, which obviously we know that Alan hasn't really had much of a family kind of for the majority of his life. So the fact that a corporate family is what he considers to be his family, again, is a slightly tragic statement and a damning indictment about the state of his relationship with his loved ones.
Well, which he sort of puts very faintly by saying, my own children don't massively like me. And then I've got a quote here that is entirely out of context, but I just wrote it down because I enjoyed it, where he just says Anton de Becker sprayed his pizzazz all over the seats. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say this. We've got to try and illustrate the power of celebrity. Gives three examples. Does anyone have any notes on these? I thought these were pretty good.
Well, I've just got that it's Anton de Becker and Michael Aspel saying that these figures get people interested in mid tier cars, but that's kind of the only thing that I've
got. I think I've got the combination. So yeah, so the Anton de Becker is with a Vauxhall Astra. Michael Aspel is with a Ford Focus. Next to it on a fold-up chair, and I really like this bit. Another example involving Des Lynam in a van, so he doesn't flesh out the full details.
A nondescript van, no brand name required.
We find out though at this point that not every celebrity is interested in corporate work. Alan then goes on to reference Fiona Bruce, who, if you know you're stuck at her with a cocktail party, will give you chapter and verse about her public service agenda. However, at this point, Alan finds a copy of Cheshire Life magazine where she won't stop talking about Isley or Isley Garden Centre, which Alan has basically interpreted as some kind of paid for promotion, when in actual fact it's a lifestyle piece where she's just given an example of how she likes to relax on the weekend.
He says that, you know, to her and to some other people, corporate is a dirty word, like fanny or piss. I also found out the other day that if you present current affairs and news on TV, you're not allowed to be in a TV ad of any kind. And that's why you have to wait for people like Trevor McDonald to retire before they then pop up on any ad that will have them, basically.
Did not know. Yeah. Even though it's just a small line, I did enjoy Alan calling the managing director of Morphe Richards Morphe.
Yes. Morphe, you didn't have to do this.
My name isn't Morphe.
I guess the thing is, what is quite good about this episode is kind of the lampooning of the kind of corporate world and the corporate culture. So, you know, mocking the celebrity endorsements of, like, just because you've got Des Lynam next to a van, it's going to make people interested in it. And I think also there's something to be said for the almost like the kind of targets they have in terms of Morphe Richards, Robert Dias, Shoe Zone. It's kind of, you know, they do a very good job of, like, illustrating kind of like Britain, like Partridge's Britain or whatever, you know, this thing about kettles and toasters available in red, cream, silver, black. Is there anything I've missed?
Yeah, it's kind of unremarkable brands, unremarkable people, and I wouldn't say, like, you know, mundane things that he's talking about, but like you say, it's a kind of a chink into what life in middle of the road corporate Britain is some respects. Yeah. Does anyone want to give any insight as to what Doug McKenna, brand director for Robert Dias, does?
Yes, he lifts morale by turning employee names into rude words.
Have you got the examples, Adam?
I haven't got the list, no. Please hit me with them if you've got them.
I've got it. So Grant Pope becomes Pant Grope. Roger Hart becomes Roger Tard. And Alan Partridge is Anal Partridge. It's absolutely savage.
And the extension to that line, but my God, it's a cracking way to get a team buzzing.
Yeah, sure.
There's another example that comes from Brandon Greaves, sales manager for Homebase, who basically makes people eat Cheerios from a dog bowl if they fail to make a sale.
That sounds horrendous.
You've got one more captain of industry, Derek Eggers, who runs social media for Shoe Zone.
Yeah, this one is obviously so ludicrous and over the top that he'll only employ people that have done a gold Duke of Edinburgh award. I looked at the entry requirements for doing the Duke of Edinburgh Gold Award. I'm not going to read it out because it's massive, but one of them includes volunteering for 12 months. So to even be considered to work at Shoe Zone, you need to go away and do 12 months voluntary work.
Has anyone done Duke of Edinburgh? Like, I haven't. I don't really even know what it is, to be honest with you.
I am bronze qualified.
So what does that mean?
I did it at my school, but I didn't do it.
And why only bronze, crucially?
Six months on Twitter for Shoe Zone, was it?
You basically, it's a kind of like, I guess...
You're orienteering and stuff, don't you?
Yeah, there's like kind of four different things around kind of, orienteering, volunteering. God, I can't think what the other things were. But yeah, I had to like volunteer at the vets, which I loved. Apart from the night I saw a dog being put down. That's still with me. And then, just out and about camping. It's basically young people having a nice time and just kind of...
Is it basically being in Scouts or something?
Yeah, it's basically an extension of the Scouts run by the royal family that's probably a racket for getting money out of people.
Nick Alder has said that, not the members of Monkey Tennis. The views and opinions of Nick Alder do not represent the views and opinions of Monkey Tennis.
But Nick, why only bronze? Where did it go wrong?
Well... I can tell. I mean, I'm not going to read out the gold requirements, but it gets increasingly demanding on your personal time.
So it's not like you get graded on how you performed. It's like if you sign up for more commitment, you'll get gold or silver or something.
Well, do you have to pay?
Yeah, you do have to pay. And
so
I would say this.
It's kind of like Scientology. If you want to get gold, if you want to get the top, you have to pay.
Yeah.
Nick
wasn't prepared to go clear, not even for a lucrative Shoe Zone position. I like that there's a sort of continuation of this kind of Middle England thing where he talks about examples of people who inspire him, and the list consists of Vanessa Phelps and Paddy McGuinness.
So Alan has been back onto Twitter, which I wonder, I kind of feel like this going to Twitter thing, I wonder if it's just a bit of a literary device to kind of almost not bulk out the word count, but it's a nice way to kind of, interject or provide a bit of like easy writing in terms of just making, daft observations from the things that people say on Twitter. And I don't say that as a criticism, but it's just like, what do we do now? Or we can probably go to a bit of, Twitter humour now.
I'd agree. I think it works in the real world writing level and also in the APU level, that it's just, it allows a bit of freedom to kind of go anywhere with what happens next. And actually, I think... it's kind of surprising that for Alan, it kind of is a new regular feature. He does go to Twitter nearly every episode. Yeah. What I really enjoyed about him going to Twitter in this episode is there's a line he says, some terrific thoughts coming in on that. So he's treating Twitter responses a bit like it's a live radio phone in. That's his default mode, the way he describes it like that.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
Are we on to his great chat about variations of handshakes?
Yes, this is from Brian in Epsom, who says there's no better way than to impress a captain of industry than a firm handshake. And he basically says you need to grip the hand and count to 10, although crucially don't count out loud, or just keep shaking the hand until the recipient has stopped smiling, which I kind of enjoyed.
I like Alan's elaboration on how to end a handshake with a fan is to push them away with the other hand, which leaves them happy because you touch them with both hands.
Yeah. There's a tweet from Red Star, which I kind of also enjoyed, which was, again, I wondered how much of this was maybe, peppering in, probably not just what Coogan thinks, but probably what a lot of people think, in that big business can take a lot from society in general, and that we shouldn't necessarily kind of worship at the altar of what are kind of described as morally bankrupt multinationals. I don't know if that was kind of a bit of, kind of capturing the kind of modern attitude towards big business.
Is that also a little bit of biting the hand that feeds you vis-a-vis Audible / Amazon there? Perhaps. I wonder. The other thing that I thought was quite interesting is that he says he describes it as a tweet, but the thing that he reads out, it must be 1,000 characters long plus. So
I think thought that as well.
I guess it could be a thread, but you know, Alan doesn't distinguish between a thread or a tweet.
That's a really good point. But in the letters episode, the tweet about the granddad letter, there's no way that could be a tweet because that's super long as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a question to the group at this point. Does Steve Coogan like Julian Fellows?
I'm going to go with not his biggest fan.
Yeah. I don't really know much about Julian Fellows, so like, is that kind of grounded in fact? Like, how embellished is that? I don't
know.
Not that
I can see, but Fellows has a bit of a reputation for being a bit of an arse, I think. But obviously he created Downton Abbey and also wrote Gosford Park as well, which won an Oscar. And I think he's kind of always been part of loosely on the outskirts of like high society and the monarchy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he has two life ambitions: to marry into the aristocracy and to be knighted. Now, he has married into the aristocracy broadly, but I couldn't see any reference to him being knighted. So I don't know if that's... Because he says that he's achieved both of those things, but I couldn't see, looking at his Wikipedia page, that he actually has been knighted. And I seem to remember that rumour about him directing, like, in full, almost kind of riding gear to be...
Oh, really?
And in tweed. I did read about that.
Oh, but I see. Again, that's not just a device for this episode. That is kind of like a rumour.
Yeah. Right. I don't think it's ever been proved, but I have heard references to what he was like on set.
It's just so the way that they word it is just so cutting, where in reference to the tweed, Alan says, well, many think he should just be slapped across the face. I actually think it shows panache.
That's an Alan kind of, yes, Coogan no.
Yeah, and absolutely just, having your cake and eating it statement as well.
Yeah. So I imagine he's written himself out of probably any future Julian Fellows productions. But it's probably,
I think he's probably all right with that. Yeah, I can't imagine that Coogan is much of a monarchist.
Yeah, it's all right. As long as Michael Winterbottom will have him back, he's golden.
Yes.
Yeah. So has anyone got the two reasons that Alan would leave a corporate night out to a club? He doesn't want to go home, but he will if A, people start wearing ties around their heads, or B, there are three of you left and the other man and woman are necking. otherwise, he's in it for the long haul.
Oh, and of course, I don't think we mentioned about that sometimes these corporate events move on after their evening drinks receptions, where the warm white wine becomes Alan and three hardcore revelers in a Chinese restaurant doing Ali G impressions. That's a very nailed on image as well, I thought. And again, it's kind of like it's saying about like Daryl Flench and his mates. In my mind, it's David Brent and Finchie. It's that world. It's the Swindon lot and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Has anyone got any notes on Alan's vocal warm-ups?
No.
No.
Okay, I enjoyed this. I'll cover it if no one else has it. So he's doing some vocal warm-ups in the car on the way to the event, which he says he'll either do to Paul Simon or The Lion Sleeps Tonight, at which point he starts singing the A Wimbleway, A Wimbleway. But that gets Seldon barking. Or
I love that.
At this point, he's referenced as Seldy, which I did enjoy. And also, you hear Alan call him Daddy. He's Seldy, it's Daddy.
Also, a bit of a weird throwaway line that he won't sing along to The Lion King because he knows the musical set designer and he never shuts up about it. That seems so specific. Seems so specific that I wonder if it's almost either rooted in some kind of real life experience or there's a joke there that's gone over my head.
Well, there's definitely the element of like, that's a sort of petty behaviour you'd expect from Alan. So if somebody's proud of the work they've done, he's not going to help share in that pride. Mm-hmm. But,
that's a good point. So Alan has returned home early from the corporate event and has avoided the drinks reception. Did anyone pick up? I swear he said bottles. I don't know if anyone else heard or clocked that, but I think, again, in terms of mangled English, I definitely heard bottles of Beck's.
Yes. Yeah, I think he sort of slips into Americanisms quite a bit, and there was a little bit of that in the letters episode as well.
Yeah, there's a lot more to come in the next episode as well.
Yeah.
So why has Alan left the event early?
Well, presumably because there were three of them left and the other man and woman were necking, or people started to wear ties around their heads. No?
Yeah. No, isn't this... He thinks that High Noon was there.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's fairly certain he was at the event.
Yeah. So Alan is doing a Q&A kind of Twitter read-along with the CEO, so asking kind of questions, and at this point a Twitter message comes up from High Noon that says, "Nice trousers," which obviously sends Alan into an absolute panic at this point. And basically he goes into a meltdown, because Alan basically always will wear trousers to a corporate event, which means that basically High Noon probably isn't there, because he's just guessing that he's wearing trousers, apart from a time that he did a corporate for Vodafone where he wore a kilt because he was pretending to be a Scottish skinflint.
I like that the consequence of him coming home early is that he's going to make Rosa walk home at night with a torch. It's 8:15 and he's packed her off into the night.
Oh, and also I think don't you get, just as you hear the door slam, you hear Rosa kind of react like, what? Like, she's a bit shocked that she's being sent packing with a torch, I think.
So Alan discovers that High Noon wasn't there, but Alan believes that he sabotaged his brain, and he's been taken out early by the CFO, and at this point Alan's been sick on a Jag.
Yeah, I just have a quote as my final note from this episode. Hello, I've been sick and I want chicken.
I think the follow-up quote to that is also brilliant, where they say, oh, what do you want? And he just says, a bucket of breaded battery bits.
I mean, that is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, this is a kind of a familiar joke, but Alan also has to kind of scrub his hands, because seldom will, and this is just such a perfect word, be in a mood if he finds out that Alan has gone to KFC. The idea that Alan can interpret his mood in reference to him going to KFC, I think, is lovely.
And then Alan says, right then, bye, and end of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree this is quite a slight episode in terms of not much happens, but if you summarise it briefly, he effectively talks about how much he loves corporate work, but then left a corporate event because somebody tweeted, nice trousers. That's the summary of this half an hour or 20-minute episode.
I think it's kind of sweet at the end, because he's like, he wraps it up so quickly because he just wants to be with Seldom because he's feeling a bit off-kilter. That's quite nice. Like, there actually is a bond there. A couple of other bits. He says his mind was spinning like a Ford Escort doing donuts, so at this point not like trainers going around in a washing machine, which I was surprised not to hear that, but I think that does appear in a few episodes time. To be fair to him as well, I actually think he did make one quite good joke at this corporate event, where he says, sorry, I didn't know what I was talking about then. You must have thought I was the head of R&D for Nissan. I thought, to be fair to him, that joke at that car launch probably would have absolutely killed.
And it brought the house down, yeah, as Alan says.
Yes, so that's the end of that episode of Oast House and the end of this episode of Monkey Tennis. We'll be back next week taking a deep breath of the clean air of LA. If you'd like to get in touch with us in the meantime, we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, on Twitter at The Partridge Pod, facebook.com/The Partridge Pod, email us at thepartridgepod@gmail.com, or if you'd like to leave a voice note, send it via WhatsApp and it might end up in a future episode. Call the Monkey Tennis hotline on 07923 600 017. If you've been enjoying what you've heard from us, then please do give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast provider, or even go as far as dropping us the price of a coffee at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks and goodbye.
Thank you for listening, and please carry on listening.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle. Monkey tennis?
Yup-salutely, yup-yup-yup-salutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the Oast House.
Keep it down, love.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.